good afternoon, everyone. It is a pleasure to welcome you here today. For those of you that I do not know, my name is Benjamin Hopkins. I'm the director of the Seeger Center for Asian Studies here at the Elliott School and the George Washington University. And it's my great pleasure to welcome you to today's event. We have a distinguished panel both this afternoon and this evening, and I hope you'll be able to hang around for both. And I think we're going to have a good discussion, both from the panelists as well as no doubt from the questions and comments generated by you, the participants. It's my pleasure to welcome you to How Does Taiwan's Defense and Security Status Stack Up? We've divided today's events in two, with an afternoon and an evening program, punctuated by high tea in the middle, so you will get your caffeine injection to see you all the way through. It's my pleasure as well to moderate this first panel, and in so doing, I'll just briefly introduce the speakers to this first panel, whose bios can all be found in your very nicely done program for this afternoon, and who I won't belabor, as you can read essentially their CVs there. First of all, we'll have Bonnie Glazer, who is really a cornerstone of Taiwan everything here at GW, and I think more broadly at in Washington, D.C. Bonnie is based at CSIS and runs a very active program looking at China and East Asia and Taiwan. We also have Lieutenant General Chip Gregson, who's at the Center for the National Interest, who's going to be joining us this afternoon. And then thirdly, we have Richard Fisher, who's at the International Assessment and Strategy Center. Each one of these speakers will take maybe 15 minutes or so to deliver their remarks. And then once they've been delivered, we'll open the floor to questions and comments, which will be moderated. So please join me in welcoming this first panel as we get this event rolling.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you to GW and the Seeger Center for inviting me over to participate in another one of their great programs. Thank you, Deepa, for reaching out. It is always a pleasure to come and to GW and talk about issues related to Taiwan and East Asia security. So Taiwan's security is under threat, and it is under threat from the People's Republic of China. The PRC claims that Taiwan is part of China. As you know, it seeks reunification under a formula that both Taiwan's government and its people reject. In 2005, Beijing passed the anti-secession law, set out conditions under which it would use, as the language states, non-peaceful means against Taiwan. And just recently in Beijing, they held the National People's Congress, and Xi Jinping warned that separatist efforts, quote, will be condemned by the Chinese people and punished by history. The PRC threat to Taiwan's security takes many forms. Beijing has stepped up efforts to exclude Taiwan from participating in international organizations. It has wooed away some of its diplomatic partners, now leaving Taiwan with 20 diplomatic allies. China's economic pressure is growing. It includes barring Chinese tour groups from visiting Taiwan, warning countries not to negotiate bilateral economic agreements with Taiwan, and thwarting Taiwan from participating in multilateral economic agreements. Militarily, of course, the PLA continues to develop and deploy military capabilities that are intended to coerce Taiwan and, if necessary, if they deem necessary, to invade the island. So before I talk about the U.S. role in Taiwan's security, I think I have to say that the most critical variable in Taiwan's security is Taiwan itself. Implementing policies that enhance Taiwan's appeal as an economic partner, attracting investment, increasing the competitiveness of Taiwanese companies. These are examples of steps that Taiwan's government can take to further strengthen the nation's economic security. Investing more resources in defense and pursuing innovative and asymmetric concepts and technologies are essential to maintaining deterrence and to increasing the military's capability to defend the island. Creative diplomacy aimed at making friends all around the world, and especially deepening Taiwan's partnerships in the Indo-Pacific region, is especially important because greater isolation will weaken Taiwan's security, and deeper relationships will strengthen it. Tsai Ing-wen's new southbound policy I view as an exemplar of such creative diplomacy. Now, of all the countries in the world, the United States plays the most important role in Taiwan's security. As a vibrant democracy with deep historical ties to the United States, including, of course, as a former treaty ally, Taiwan enjoys very strong support from the U.S. Congress. And we saw the unanimous passage of the Taiwan Travel Act. And that is just, I think, the most recent manifestation of Congress's strong backing for Taiwan. In March 2016, just over 1 year ago, the U.S. Congress also passed legislation supporting Taiwan to become an observer in Interpol, the International Criminal Police Organization. Taiwan's defense has been a focal point of concern for Republican and Democratic administrations alike. And under the 1979 Taiwan Relations Act, we all know the United States is obligated to, quote, sell defense articles and services in such quantity as may be necessary to enable Taiwan to maintain a sufficient self-defense capability. U.S. arms sales to Taiwan serve it as much a political purpose as a military one. Both Taipei and Beijing rightly regard such sales as a signal of U.S. commitment to Taiwan's security. The TRA also mandates that the U.S. maintain the capacity, again, quote, to resist any resort to force other than forms of coercion, resist any resort to force or other forms of coercion that would jeopardize the security or the social or economic system of the people on Taiwan. Although the details of U.S. military exchanges and other forms of security cooperation are not always public, it is well known that the United States plays a key role in supporting Taiwan's defense efforts. One small example, which is often made public, is the U.S. dispatch of a usually senior retired military officer to Taiwan's annual Hanguang military exercises. Washington also plays a critical role in helping Taiwan to expand its participation in the international community. So one of the, I think, great high points of that those efforts and U.S. policy is the Global Cooperation and Training Framework. And I remember there was a senior official from the State Department who came here just a few years ago and talked about GCTF. And through GCTF, the U.S. partners with Taiwan's government and civil society groups to advance and elevate Taiwan's regional and global leadership across a range of issues. Some of these include democracy and human rights, trafficking in persons, youth engagement, aboriginal rights, women's empowerment, global health, e-commerce, energy, and environmental protection. It's a long list, and it's going to get longer, because there's a lot of good things that the United States is working on with Taiwan through the GCTF program. Together, experts from the U.S. and Taiwan hold workshops that enable Taiwan to share information, best practices with experts from around the world. So the Trump administration inherited a strong U.S.-Taiwan relationship, and it's working to further enhance bilateral ties and reinforce Taiwan's security. For the first time ever, I'm sure everybody in this room knows, Taiwan was mentioned in the national security strategy that was issued at the end of last year. And there was one particular sentence in that NSS that states, "We will maintain our strong ties with Taiwan in accordance with our One China policy, including our commitments under the Taiwan Relations Act, to provide for Taiwan's legitimate defense needs and deter coercion." In my view, this is a clear signal that the Trump administration recognizes that threats to Taiwan's security are growing and require a stronger response. The National Security Strategy also lays out the U.S. vision for the Indo-Pacific, and that includes forging closer ties with partners that share respect for sovereignty, for what is said to be fair and reciprocal trade, the rule of law, maintaining freedom of navigation, unimpeded commerce, and the peaceful resolution of disputes. And recently, Alex Wang, our Deputy Assistant Secretary from the State Department, gave a speech in Taipei at the American Chamber of Commerce. President Tsai Ing-wen, of course, was there. And Alex Wang said that Taiwan, the U.S., and all like-minded countries can work together to strengthen the free and open order of the Indo-Pacific. In the economic sphere, he specifically highlighted Taiwan's role in promoting the rules-based international system by constantly improving its legal and regulatory environment and protecting intellectual property, once again underscoring that Taiwan is the first place where defense and protection and strengthening of Taiwan's security begins. Alex Wang also talked about, the new southbound policy. And from my perspective, there is indeed a synergy between the evolving U.S. Indo-Pacific strategy and Taiwan's new southbound policy. Building closer ties between Taiwan and its Southeast Asian, South Asian, and Pacific neighbors, and more deeply integrating Taiwan into the region, which are the main goals of the new southbound policy, will help advance Washington's objectives of strengthening the rules-based order in the Indo-Pacific, and importantly, fortifying Taiwan's prosperity and security. Alex Wang also gave remarks a few days ago, I think it was Monday, at the State Department, and he talked about the Trump administration's free and open Indo-Pacific strategy. Lots of people ask questions, you know, so what is this strategy? We haven't seen all that much. The president talked about it in Da Nang last November, and of course it was included in the National Security Strategy in December. But I think it was important that an official who is in charge of the free and open Indo-Pacific, as Alex Wang is, came out to talk to the press about what the administration means by free and open and what its plans are. So I see the administration is beginning to put some meat on the bones of this strategy. And one of the things that Alex noted is that by free, the United States means that the nations of the region should be free from coercion so they can defend their sovereignty and pursue their interests as they see fit. Free also means democratic, good governance with high levels of transparency, low levels of corruption, and protection of human rights. So Taiwan shares, of course, with many small countries of the region, the challenge of being targeted by Beijing's pressure and coercion. And Taipei can assist in some of the like-minded new southbound countries to help improve, strengthen governance, and advance freedom in their countries. There's also potential for other forms of cooperation. So Taiwan's Coast Guard could help partners in Southeast Asia increase their law enforcement capabilities so they can protect their sovereign rights within their exclusive economic zones. So moving from free to open, Alex Wang talked about open meaning open logistics, particularly infrastructure, and open investment and open markets. And again, Taiwan has a potential role to play in building regional economic connectivity in South Asia and Southeast Asia. Taiwan's construction companies can partner with Japan, with the United States, to build infrastructure projects across the region. So in short, Taipei can make a significant contribution to promoting a free and open Indo-Pacific. The U.S. and Taiwan share interests and values. They believe in the rule of law, and they have similar visions for the region. So we should find ways to work together. The Trump administration's assessment of China as a rival, a revisionist power, and a strategic competitor may create more opportunities for the United States to collaborate with Taiwan in the region and beyond. Trump administration officials, I sense, are somewhat less concerned than preceding administrations about Beijing's possible objections to U.S. efforts to bolster Taiwan's ties with Taiwan and to shore up Taiwan's security. And I think this is at least in part a function of growing concerns about the broad range of threats that China is seen as posing to American interests, but it's also likely due to the belief that Taiwan is an unappreciated partner of the United States, and that the United States should do more to strengthen the security of Taiwan and the well-being of its people. So we recently saw, again, two deputy assistant secretaries go to Taiwan. Das Wong was followed by the deputy assistant secretary of commerce for manufacturing, Ian Steff. And I think these are likely indicators of the Trump administration's determination to redouble U.S. efforts to enhance Taiwan's security. In areas where there are opportunities to work together to strengthen ties between our people, to advance our shared interests, I think it can be expected that there will be additional senior level exchanges in the future. Beijing's attempts to intimidate Taiwan and to isolate Taiwan's government and civil society from the international community are harmful to American interests. China's coercion and bullying should not go unanswered. In addition to its legal obligations, the United States has a moral responsibility to help Taiwan resist Chinese pressure. I remember when President George W. Bush was president and he called Taiwan a beacon of democracy. And I always thought that was a very good descriptor. It is in American interest to ensure that Taiwan's democracy grows stronger, that Taiwan's economy becomes even more prosperous, that Taiwan's defense capabilities become more robust, and that Taiwan's connectivity with the region and the world is increased. The United States has a key role to play in ensuring that Taiwan's future is paved by its people and is not dictated by Beijing. The U.S. role in Taiwan's security has always been important, and it will continue to be crucial going forward. Taiwan is not a bargaining chip to be used to get a good deal with China. It is a long-standing friend and a close partner of the United States. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you, Bonnie. Next up, we have Chip Gregson, who will be talking about the rise of revisionist powers and strategic challenges for the U.S. and Taiwan.
Now, my thanks to Benjamin and Deepa for hosting all of us here today. This feels a little bit like a courtroom, but it's got a marvelous view, affording those who want to check out from the conference mentally to look at an organized part of Washington from here. As Ben said, my assignment was to talk about the rise of revisionist powers and strategic challenges for the U.S. and Taiwan. Today's Republic of China was born of emerging revisionist power challenges at the end of World War II and the dawn of the Cold War, and it remains hostage to the health of the international order in Asia. In September 1945, we were lord of all we surveyed in Asia. We assumed that our ally, nationalist China, under Chiang Kai-shek, would become a major power, a member of the Permanent Five in the United Nations Security Council. That was codified at the Yalta Conference, despite China's absence. And there being nobody left to fight, we redeployed back home in a hurry and rapidly demobilized. But by the early 1950s, we were in pretty much disarray. The USSR, our wartime allies, subverted Eastern European governments, blockaded West Berlin, and exploded its own atomic device. Nationalist China, another wartime ally, was defeated by the Communist Rebellion and retreated to Formosa, as the island was called then. And President Truman's administration stood accused by radical Republicans of losing China. In June 1950, North Korea invaded South Korea, and President Truman, fearing humiliation if another country was lost to communism, and fearing that a precedent would encourage Soviet action in Europe, deployed troops to South Korea and sent a unit from the much-reduced 7th Fleet to guard the Taiwan Strait. Perhaps China, absorbed as it was with consolidation after their civil war, would not have moved on Taiwan, but the precedent of protection was established. It remains today only in the provisions of the Taiwan Relations Act. Today, Taiwan is a self-determined, self-governing entity standing as a strong rebuke to the PRC as a vigorous, thriving rule of law democracy. It was not born a democracy, but it transformed its government from authoritarianism to democracy. It endures today as a great success despite pressure and obstacles. Today, Taiwan's defense and security depends on the strength of Taiwan's sense of identity and confidence as a self-determined, self-governed, liberal, democratic nation. Taiwan's sense of identity and confidence are strongly affected by the state of the liberal democratic order, the global operating system championed by the United States following the World War to replace the system of empire, colonialism, fascism, and authoritarianism that brought catastrophe to the world twice in the first half of the 20th century. Today, this order is under assault. China, Russia, and North Korea have profoundly changed the status quo in Asia. Our reactions to date have not been effective. Given today's emerging threats, better reasons could not be designed to promptly enhance our alliance capabilities, especially in missile and air defense, yet little is being done. The deployment of Aegis Ashore in Japan in 2022 is not relevant to today's urgent deployment and deterrence requirements. Elsewhere, Russia seized Crimea and invaded eastern Ukraine using little green men in unmarked uniforms to mask the use of Russia's armed forces. Russia continues to apply pressure to the Baltic states. Russia engages in aggressive cyber attacks and interfered in US elections. Russia attempted to assassinate a former intelligence officer in London with a prohibited chemical weapon. China declared an air defense identification zone over the East China Sea and applied territorial airspace rules in contravention of normal practice, and then declared that aircraft not following their rules would be met with emergency defensive measures, a not very veiled threat. China asserted, quote, undisputed historical sovereignty over the entire South China Sea. China conducted land creation projects, and I specifically avoid the use of reclamation. There was no land to reclaim. Land creation projects on rocks and low tide elevations in the Spratly Islands to build ports and airfields in the South China Sea. These operations caused extensive damage to coral formations, risking destruction of the ecosystem and potential food shortages. China is still expanding on these features. China has achieved de facto control over the South China Sea. Yes, the United States can still fly, sail, and operate wherever international law allows, as we've said, but the same is not true for Vietnamese fishermen or Philippine fishermen or other people engaged in lawful activities on the seas. China looks at Taiwan like Russia looked at Crimea, a key territory to control in asserting its power in the Asia Pacific. China uses its maritime militia and fishing craft to put pressure on the Senkaku Islands and Okinawa Prefecture in the East China Sea, requiring continuous Japanese Coast Guard response. China continues aerial intrusions into Japanese airspace to impose cost on Japan in response. Included in these flights are simulated cruise missile attacks on Japan's homeland, so they cannot be easily ignored. Corporations wishing to do business in China are required to surrender intellectual property and conform to Beijing's rules on censorship. North Korea deployed and employed a weapon of mass destruction, VX gas, in Malaysia. North Korea's nuclear and missile defense and missile programs are nearing maturity despite decades of sanctions and prohibitions, allowing them to achieve tremendous leverage over their near neighbors and the United States. The real danger from North Korea is North Korea's effort to degrade or destroy our alliances. Our personalization of North Korea's nuclear threat without any mention of allied interest or cooperation damages alliance credibility. Taiwan has reason to fear being used as a bargaining chip. Collectively, these and other incremental actions have become known as gray zone conflict, occurring at a level between peace and war. They have also been called hybrid warfare. Thus far, the U.S. and our allies have not found an effective response. Countering coercion requires acceptance of risk, something we have not been able to do when faced with Russian, Chinese, and North Korean incremental advances. Freedom House describes the last decade as one of retreat for democratic values around the world. The number of nations not free is rising, the number of free naturally declining. In Asia, Japan, the Republic of Korea, and Taiwan are considered free. The Philippines, Malaysia, and Indonesia, partly free, not surprisingly, are China, Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, and Thailand. The analogy is not exact, but Taiwan begins to look like West Berlin in the Cold War. Pew Research Center polling is similarly discouraging. Less than 20% of people in the Republic of Korea trust President Trump to do the right thing. Japan, Australia, and Indonesia are a little better with somewhere between 20 and 30% trusting President Trump and therefore the United States to do the right thing. The liberal international order, the global operating system that defeated the Cold War's existential threat without reversion to yet another great power war, will not continue without meaningful support. Without reversal of the current strategic trends, without a revitalization of support for the liberal international order that did so much to support Asia's rise, Taiwan as a nation and Taiwanese as individuals will be thinking of options and hedging strategies. Thank you.
Thank you, Chip. And we're going to round out this panel with Richard Fisher, who is joining us all the way from Santiago, he just told me. He's going to be talking about Taiwan's future threat environment and the need for U.S. policy adjustments.
Okay. Left, right?
Right.
There we go. Ben, Deepa, thank you very much for this kind invitation to join this panel of experts that I truly respect and who have taught me a great deal over the course of my time in Washington. I won't go into how long that time has been, but when I was the age of some of you out there, I was eagerly reading Bonnie's articles and citing them in my university papers. But
I'm only 40.
Childhood prodigy.
But yes, up here we have two images taken yesterday on the tarmac at a Chilean air base that hosted their biannual FIDE air show. An F-35 on the top and a KC-135 on the bottom. Two air platforms that Taiwan's new Minister of Defense recently stated they would like to acquire during testimony before the Taiwan Legislative Yuan. Now, what's the relationship between Santiago and air shows in Taiwan?